Okay, we'll call case number 24-6262, United States v. Threet. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Amy Senya on behalf of the appellant, Mr. D'Angelo Threet. May it please the court. Rule 32 imposes an affirmative duty on the district court to verify that a defendant and his counsel have read and discussed the pre-sentence report. Here, while the court initially satisfied this duty through its routine question to defense counsel at the beginning of the hearing, that changed during allocution, when Mr. Threet stated that actually his lawyer hadn't reviewed and discussed the PSI with him. At that point, the district court had a couple of options. It could have accepted Mr. Threet's claim and delayed sentencing, or it could have asked follow-up questions to resolve any potential conflict between what Mr. Threet and his counsel had each said.
Counsel, it seems like you are really expecting a lot of the district court's sua sponte duty here. And this ties in a little bit to this threshold question that we have to decide, which is whether the error is preserved, right? So when you say that at this point the district court had a couple of options, well, no one put the district court on notice about what those options were or what you wanted to have happen, right? And I'm not sure how we should be thinking about that, both in terms of whether the district court erred, but also in terms of whether the issue is preserved.
So to start with your first point, Your Honor, I don't think we're expecting a lot of the district court at all. I've never seen a case, the government has not cited a case where a situation like this happened. There's four cases cited in the briefing where the defendant said himself, hey, I've never seen the PSR. And in every single one of those cases, the district court knew exactly what to do. It paused the proceedings, it inquired further, it got to the bottom of things, and then it made a finding, whether or not the review actually happened. In one of the cases in Smith, that was in the same district, the Western District of Oklahoma, with a different panel lawyer. That's not the error on appeal, because the district court fixed it, but the district court found that the defendant was telling the truth. And so we're not expecting a lot if the district court is told affirmatively, you haven't met your duty to verify because I'm telling you that this review didn't happen. All the district court has to do is then resolve that dispute, ask a few more questions, get more information, like district courts do all the time during the course of their regular duties.
So is your position that it's sort of self-executing, that if if the district court asks, you know, makes an effort to determine that counsel has reviewed the PSR with his or her client, and, you know, the client says no, that the rule, in and of itself contemplates that the district court's going to take further action without anyone even saying anything.
That's right, Your Honor. The text of the rule is clear. It requires verification. It says the district court must verify. And if the defendant says no, even if his counsel says yes, then what the district court is presented with is a conflict, a dispute. The district court has to resolve, otherwise
it can't. A dispute between the lawyer and the client? What is the dispute that you say needs to be resolved?
In general, Your Honor, or?
Here.
Here, it's not even clear that there was a dispute. If counsel is asked about an opportunity, that's perfectly consistent with Mr. Threet saying, that opportunity never actually happened. I never actually reviewed the PSR with him. But if we can see that as a dispute, then that's something that the district court has to resolve before it can move on, because it can't possibly be verification if the district court doesn't know which version of events is true.
Well, how should we be thinking about what we have in the record that evidences the district court's understanding of your client's claim during his allocution? Because you cite to us, you rely on Holguin Hernandez for this proposition that you don't need magic language. Fully agree. But Holguin doesn't really speak to how we're to look at what the district court then says, because that seems to me to be instructive of, okay, here's a court saying, this is how I receive your statement. And here, the district court received it as, I'm not going to take up any of the defendant's complaints during his allocution aimed at his defense counsel. And so it seems to me the district court understood this as a, and even your client said, ineffective assistance. So why isn't it reasonable at that point for the district court to understand this not as a Rule 32 problem, but as a problem about, okay, this defendant is unhappy with his lawyer, and that's not for right now.
So we can look to the decisions in the other circuits, Mark and Scott, where almost exactly the same thing happened, where a defendant stated on the record during sentencing, I've never seen the PSR, I don't know what it says. And in those cases, the court applied the same core rule that didn't cite Hogan Hernandez, but the same rule of it was brought to the district court's attention. And that's not, to my understanding, a subjective inquiry of what the district court in its own mind was believing, whether it was listening well enough. It's whether it was brought to the attention. And this is during allocution. And so this court has said in Jarvie that allocution is a special time. That's the time for the defendant as an individual to bring concerns up with the court related to sentencing. And so the district court wasn't free to decide not to take it up, whether the district court wasn't listening or he didn't understand.
Oh. Counsel, can I interrupt you for a second? You admit that we're on plain error review here, assuming error.
No, Your Honor, we don't agree that we're on plain error. We think this is preserved just as it would be in the Third Circuit and the First Circuit. But we can satisfy plain error, which we argued in the alternative.
What is the injury to your client, assuming error?
So for prejudice, the requirement that this court set out in Ronhell under Rule 32 is very similar, if not the same, as the prejudice inquiry would be for third prong for substantial rights on plain error. And that's basically, we have to show that the error mattered. And in Ronhell, we do that in two ways. We first have to offer evidence or assert contradictory facts to challenge the PSR's accuracy, which we have done here. And then second, we have to show that error, that whatever mistake it was in the PSR, that would have mattered, that could have affected the sentence. And we've done both of those things here.
Well, what is the prejudice here?
So
how is the client prejudiced?
So the prejudice, Your Honor, is that Mr. Three was not able to challenge two enhancements that significantly affected his guidelines range. It doubled his guidelines range from what would have been 77 to 96 months all the way to 188 to 235 months, which was above the 180-month statutory maximum, which is what he ultimately received here. And so he was not able to challenge these enhancements, which were based on hearsay allegations, sometimes multiple levels of hearsay, without actually any proof, because it wasn't challenged, so the district court was allowed to accept them as true. And he didn't get the opportunity to actually engage in any sort of dispute about that and challenge them and have a chance to have those enhancements not apply.
So how should we be thinking on that point about the fact that in defendant's sentencing memo, he sort of takes up a factual challenge to the July arrest and says it was a brief scuffle and it was a fairly quick, attempted a headlock that failed quickly. I mean, it feels to me like those are the sorts of factual challenges that you would be mounting to object to the PSR's predicate facts in support of the enhancements. That didn't happen for reasons at issue here, perhaps. But that sentencing memo troubles me because it suggests that the factual challenge was available.
The sentencing memo that the attorney drafted was a legal challenge. It was to whether the facts as alleged in the PSR rose to the level of met the legal standard of that guideline, the aggravated what is akin to aggravated assault.
Okay, so maybe you're answering my question. So you don't think that the sentencing memo is taking issue with the facts in the PSR? It doesn't do that explicitly, for sure, but it's not even sort of doing it?
It's not even sort of doing it, Your Honor. It's super clear, especially what counsel says at the sentencing hearing, that counsel's position is, you know, Your Honor, this isn't aggravated assault. This is simple assault. You know, it just doesn't rise to that level. The lawyer is saying that these facts, as they have been alleged, just aren't good enough. Not that the facts didn't happen, or not that what the officer alleges through three layers of hearsay isn't actually what went on.
And I also have, I'm really stuck on how to understand prejudice in this case. I know Judge Kelly was asking about this in terms of what you're showing is if you're on plain air, but I don't really even understand what you're attempting to do with the attachments to the opening brief. And, you know, I see that you see in our law, this is, you're trying to be responsive to what you, I think, understand our law to have required, that to show prejudice, even for preserved Rule 32 error, you have to point to something, and that's what you seem to be doing. But I don't understand where you, where that requirement comes up. And I say that for two reasons. One is that Rangel did not suggest there needed to be some sort of evidentiary showing. And that's weird because we don't take facts on appeal. That's not what we do. And then you rely on Martinez, it's unpublished, but that's a plain error case. So I don't really, I guess my question is if you could speak to where do you see this requirement where an appellant has to all of a sudden develop facts on appeal to satisfy preserved prejudice for Rule 32? And is there any daylight between preserved prejudice and prong three if you're on plain air?
I don't think there's any daylight to answer that last question, Your Honor. But this comes directly from the court's precedent and not only Rangel, but Archer, which is applying Rangel, which is a case in which the defendant attempted to show prejudice by saying, I would have challenged the loss calculation. And the court uses the same language in Rangel, and that is offer evidence or assert contradictory facts. And so if Your Honor thinks that that's just a proffer, that's an offer of proof that actually doesn't require evidence, great. That's fine. We've done that. But we wanted to make sure every defendant that's ever tried this in the Tenth Circuit has lost. And so we wanted to make sure out of an abundance of caution that we were doing everything possible.
Understood. What are we supposed to do with it? Is it supposed to be we're not supposed to be resolving the merits of factual disputes. So are we supposed to receive it in your view, assuming the law requires it and you've complied with that, that we're supposed to say, aha, there actually is a problem because you've pointed to something you could do?
So, right. The court is absolutely not resolving facts. It's not a fact finder. What the court could do is, since this is the first time anyone has actually tried to fulfill the standard, the court could say, what we meant in Rangel and Archer by assert contradictory facts was just that you have to make some sort of explanatory showing of why this would have mattered, that there's something in the PSR that you could have pointed to.
And why, I mean, I thought that when we say prejudice, we mean harmlessness. We mean prejudice as opposed to, it's not structural. Rule 32 error isn't structural. So is that the wrong way to look at it? That our cases, you think, affirmatively require a proffer or something? It's not just that, you know, you point out the error by saying, here it is. The district court didn't fulfill its Rule 32 duty. And it's not harmless because we have to show prejudice the way you do in the ordinary case under a harmlessness standard.
I think that would be the ordinary case. For whatever reason, in this specific context, it's sort of upside down land. I don't know why the court's opinions are not drafted that way, but we are trying to engage with the standard as the court has written it.
I think that's great. It seems to be a strange standard.
It is strange. And I think in the typical case, ideally it wouldn't have been written this way in 1983 when Rangel was first published, but, I think typically it is harmlessness, but because this is a weird situation where even it's if it's preserved, the defendant has to actually do the pointing out and showing how it could have affected things. That's usually the government's burden if it's harmless error. But if that is the case here, then there isn't any daylight on plain error. And so essentially the inquiries collapse, whether it's preserved or not. I see I have 12 seconds left, and I will reserve those 12 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel Cedric Bond on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start with the question of preservation, because that is really the threshold question here before the court. Because the case here started with the sentencing hearing began with this question. Mr. Autry, have you and the defendant each had an opportunity to review and discuss the pre-sentence report, including addenda and revisions since the initial draft? The response, yes, Your Honor. Now this question is coming up before the court here, whether this statement at the end or toward the end of the allocution was sufficient to alert the court that verification that he began his sentencing hearing, it began its sentencing hearing with, was not sufficient.
Well, let me stop you for a second. So, allocution is pretty sacred in this circuit. One of us sitting up here on the bench has been deemed to have committed an error by forgetting to allow it at a sentencing. It wasn't Judge Rossman. And we have a fairly recent body of case law that reverses courts who made a remark about what they plan to do at sentencing before allocution, ergo that they prejudged their sentence before the person had a chance to allocute. And that suggests pretty loudly to me that in this circuit, when a district judge has someone allocuting, that they're supposed to listen and know that it's a person who may not be skilled in the law, but they should listen to them and take action and maybe even rely on what is said in their sentencing. That seems pretty important.
Your Honor, the allocution is a very important and within the bounds of the law, sacred time. This statement that Mr. Threat made was not sufficient to alert the court that he was making a legal objection a la Rule 51B.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I've got a Rule 51B objection. I know I'm a prisoner, not skilled in the law, but my attorney didn't discuss this with me. And if he had, I have 7 objections to the PSR that you don't even know if I saw.
Your Honor, that's not what would be required.
We don't even know if he saw it.
Your Honor, the question is not whether this court right now knows whether Mr. Threat saw the PSR, but whether the district court could reasonably infer from the court documents, defendant statements, and the statements of defense counsel whether it had satisfied its obligations under Rule 32I1A.
And that's the standard.
Go ahead.
That's the standard under Rangel, right?
So this. Yes, Your Honor.
So the issue is whether we're evaluating it as preserved, and I have a question for you about Holt in just a moment. So,
yes.
Or if it's plain, the issue on error is evaluated by that legal standard. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so why, irrespective of preservation, why would there be no error here under this standard? And if you could walk me through the government's position, really most usefully would be chronologically, beginning from when the court asks the question, which didn't really track the language of the amended rule, but the court asks the question, and then what do we have in the record that would support the government's position under the Rangel standard?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as the court's obligation under Rule 32I1A to make this verification, it is a flexible standard, also from Rangel. And the court here in this case started the sentencing hearing by asking that question that I quoted there. And at that point, when counsel had given that unequivocal response, that court, the court had satisfied its obligations under Rule 32I1A and could proceed with sentencing, which is the concern behind this rule about proceeding with sentencing without having this happening.
So procedurally, at that point in the hearing, could Mr. Threat have jumped up and disputed that? Or as a matter of procedure, is he supposed to wait until it's time to allocute if there's no evidence being put on?
Your Honor, I think that whether it's the proper procedure for it to be done or not, I think that when he hears his counsel making a false statement right there, I think that it would be reasonable for him to say something at that point.
That seems just like a non-starter. I mean, it seems to require us to make assumptions that are either just fanciful or not supported by the record and not helpful in any event. I mean, what I'm trying to figure out under the standard that we're required to apply is, what is it about this record that, assuming we spot you, that when the district court asked the question and got an answer, that its Rule 32 duty was complete? What are we to do with the fact that we have a record that contains, no matter when, a defendant saying, that's not true, I didn't review it. Okay, so we have that indicia, that data point. We also have the absence of the sorts of factual objections that you would, you know, maybe typically expect to see, which appellant now explains why maybe those weren't made. So we have a record from which we have to say that the reasonable inference from everything that the court knew supports no error here. Why is that the right conclusion on this record in its totality? And I'm not persuaded by the fact that the defendant didn't jump up at the appropriate procedural moment.
Right. Your Honor,
well, he in fact did jump up at the appropriate procedural moment. Yeah. But go ahead.
Your Honor, so we start with that initial verification. Now the question is whether the defendant's statement in the midst of his allocution was sufficient to alert the district court that this issue was present. And I think earlier in your questions with appellants, you noted that there is kind of a linkage between the preservation question and the error question here. And part of that comes down to whether the district court can identify that. And I'll address that here in a second, but first, just as far as the other things that the court can look to draw this inference, we have not one motion, but two motions to extend the time to object to the initial PSR so that the defense counsel can consult with his client, and second, a motion to continue sentencing so that defense counsel can consult with his client again after the issuance of the final PSR. And those are the kind of facts in the record that this court has said district courts can look to draw the inference that it has satisfied its obligation to verify this. Now, when we get into a circumstance like this, where we have the attorney, either the attorney lying or the defendant lying, that's where we get into a complicated situation that can't really be addressed in the sentencing, and as it is done there, has to be preserved for ineffective assistance of counsel claims in that context.
Oh, I disagree. In the sentencing, the judge could have said, hold on, Mr. So-and-so, get up. Your clients just said that he didn't have an opportunity to read and discuss the PSR with you. What do you say about that? And he says, oh, Your Honor, you know, I did, or he did, or whatever. And you have the discussion right there on the record. It can be resolved presumably in minutes. And the court can then say, well, you know, I've heard from Mr. Threat, and I've heard from counsel, and Mr. Threat, sorry, your objection is just not credible to me. I believe that counsel, based on all these things in the record and what your counsel just said on the record today, that, in fact, you did have the opportunity. Objection overruled. I'm going to sentence you.
Your Honor, I would have liked it if the district court had done that.
To the statutory maximum. No, that's just the way it, that's 101. That's the way it's contemplated. That's why people allocute. So you can decide right then. They allocute so you can decide if the problem arises because of what the defendant says, you can deal with it right then. And that they don't have to sit in jail waiting on the ineffective assistance of counsel petition to percolate through.
Your Honor, I think part of this comes down to the manner in which Mr. Threat raised this. He raised it kind of sandwiched between different complaints against his counsel. And this also is a complaint against counsel. And he didn't say that he wanted to, he wanted to stop this thing so he could find out what we're all talking about, because they've just been hashing out objections to the very same enhancement that he wishes to object now, if he were to have a second go at it. But what we have here is he makes this his claims against counsel, and then he has this passing comment, an aside, where he says, oh, and P.S., my attorney never went over my PSI with me, and if he did, in which I would have withdrawn my plea, and if I could do that now, I'd like to. And so in that context, that's where we look much more like that Dunbar case that the government cited, which raised this question of pro se motions to withdraw pleas and challenges.
It wasn't a
pro
se motion to withdraw a plea. He's represented. He's represented. He has his lawyer right there. He's allocuting. So, I mean, he's not making a pro se motion. And I just think that's a non-starter. So, but what you're saying, though, makes me think about perhaps why the government wants this circuit to adopt the preservation standard that the Sixth Circuit has in Holt, right? That's you're advocating for that. We don't have a standard for procedural error under Rule 32, how to preserve that, right? We don't have a case that says how you do that.
Yes, Your Honor. That's why we cited the Holt case.
The Holt case. And just so that I understand, the difference there is, and what's missing here on this record, is you have to not just say, I didn't review it, but then ask for specifically what you want the district court, the true basis, what you want the district court to do. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why should we adopt that standard? That seems like a very highly technical standard, especially if the Rule 32 objection is coming from a defendant during elocution.
Your Honor, that's the kind of objection that this court has required for Rule 32 challenges in the past regarding, you know, not just so, like, for example, in the objections to facts in a PSR. It's not enough to object to the facts. If the judge then just makes a general finding, that you have to object to the district court's failure to make the specific finding that based on your objection. This court has adopted that, just not in this, we haven't addressed it in this context. And if the court would like, I can provide a 28J letter with a case that does that. It'd be United States versus Williamson from 1995. But you mentioned earlier the Hoagland-Hernandez standard, and that is the argument for the appellant is making for preservation here, is that just you need to point, you know, bring it to the court's attention. But the Supreme Court there expressly rejected that it was establishing the standard for procedural error, for what was necessary to preserve a procedural error. And instead, that's Rule 51B, you know, advising the court of the action that you wish the court to take or objecting to its action and the basis for that objection. And that's the grounds for what we're talking about for as far as true procedural errors. Give the district court a chance to actually know what it is that you're challenging right then and there and what you want the court to do. And then we can go for it and address it there in a more fulsome way.
Well, Rule 51B doesn't really seem to help you because it has the word or in it, right? So I think
that does help us because it's really referring to two different contexts of what's going on. If the court is doing something, then you take that second prong after the or object to the court's actions and the basis for your objection. And if the court's not doing something, then you're on the first side. Sorry, I flipped those around. But you're on the first side of objecting to the court's actions. And that's why there's the or there, is because it's addressing both district court actions that are being challenged and district court's failures to act that are being challenged.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You're out of time. Judge Kelly, do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Rossman?
I don't.
Okay. Do we have 10 seconds of rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make the quick point that we can meet plain error review here, but if the court adopts the Holt standard, which the Sixth Circuit is the only circuit that I'm aware of that has such a stringent standard, it creates a pretty difficult burden for defendants. And it's not the same as other Rule 32 errors where you're going to have a lawyer at the table with you who can object to nonspecific findings. It's a unique situation in which the defendant as a individual non-lawyer layperson is going to have to bring it to the court's attention.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted and counsel